Good morning, Fairbanks. We're on Problem Corner. I am your guest host today, Jennifer Juhas, filling in for David Pruse. And I have in the studio with me Lake Williams of the International Union of Operating Engineers and Tim Brannon with the IBEW, our electricians. And on the line, we have Mayor Grier Hopkins. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Tim, how are you guys doing today?
We're doing fantastic. I got you turned all the way up, but you're a little bit light there. If you could just speak up a little bit, Mr. Mayor, we are so grateful that you could join us.
Certainly, I have lost my voice last week, and I am down on the Quebec Peninsula fishing right now. So I'm a bit out of hand, but I am.
But you still made the time to call in for your community, and we appreciate that. Thank you so much for joining us. We talked last week about the very important subject of the gas line, and thank you for all the work that you've been doing on that. You've got your Tiger team set up. You've been testifying for the legislature, and you're down in the Kenai where we support you going fishing, but you'll also have the opportunity to talk to another local mayor who's been instrumental in providing testimony. Tell us a little bit about what's been happening the last couple of days on this gas line effort, Mr. Mayor.
From the Fairbanks perspective, you know, it starts and ends with making sure we get access to that spur line. The spur line is going to be the 30-mile line from the mainland, from the main line to the infrastructure in the interior, North Pole and Fairbanks. And if we don't get good language that guarantees that line gets built and at a price of interior residents can afford, that gas line is not going to bring home much to our interior outside of a few construction jobs at the beginning, which are important. But so I've been working hard to make sure that language stays in the bill as it passes the Senate and it passes the House or doesn't pass the House and goes to the conference committee. And wherever that's at, that has been the number one North Star that we've been looking at to make sure we keep that good language in for this Fairbanks spur line to make sure it gets delivered and affordably.
Thank you so much for your work on that. Fairbanksons know that we've been talking about that the entire 30 years I've been listening to people talk about the gas line, and I've got nods here from our folks inside the purple padded walls here. Without that spur line, we can't miss that opportunity. We want to build a gas line, and we want that spur coming to Fairbanks. So thank you for all of your efforts on that. It really is important for our community. You've been having discussions with legislators one-on-one, and what are we thinking the conference committee is going to do with that? We know that our Fairbanks legislators have worked on that, and it made it out of the House. Are you concerned? Are you hopeful?
I'm always concerned until the governor's signature is drying on the piece of paper. Dried already on the piece of paper. I'll worry even when the ink is wet. You know, the language changed in form and how it was structured, but we believe the language that is in the, that came out of the Senate, also in essence and impact, matches what came out of the House. So we're looking cautiously optimistic that we're going to be okay. Mike Kronk, the senator from much of Fairbanks, is on that conference committee, so hopefully he can keep that language in there well. And we'll be on the phone and paying attention to those backroom conversations as much as we can be a fly on the wall to know what they're doing.
And it sounds like some of those backroom conversations might take place in center stage. I know there's been some discussions to have some of that conference committee meeting more publicly. It was very refreshing to see an interior legislator like Senator Kronk on that conference committee. And I'll tell you, just from being a member of the community, watching people just drop their political affiliations and the other politics, putting them aside and doing what's right for Alaska, it has been so encouraging, Mr. Mayor, to see you and our city mayor, both Democrats, working with conservative Republicans, moderate Republicans, and independents. The gas line rally that we had up here, seeing union members there, business leaders there, and just thank you for everything that you've done to bring this community together, whether it's been labor or chamber or government, private sector. I know that you've been leading this charge with your Tiger team, and we just want to thank you for your efforts.
Of course, you know, thank you, Jen, for that. And Blake and Tim, you know, if you guys don't do the work you're doing, if we don't get jobs for Alaskans, if, you know, our assembly and our city council and the other mayors and the business leaders are not rallying and making sure it's about getting a gas line built, but a gas line that delivers affordable energy to us here in the interior is not just any old gas line. You know, 12 years ago, when the current route of the gas line was permitted, it was permitted almost completely outside of Fairbanks. That route, they routed it outside of us, away. So we've had to do extra work to make sure we get access to that gas on that spur line. It's not just, you know, if it gets built, we'll get access to it. We have to fight hard and fight like hell to make sure it's good language in there. And I want to thank, you know, Representative Diver, co-chair of House Resources. She's from right there in the downtown Fairbanks. She worked hard to get the language in the House Resources Committee as co-chair there. Rep staff did a lot of work in House Finance to keep the language in there. Senator Rob Myers in the Senate put in some good amendments that did not make it all the way through, but helped deliver that message about the need for the spur line. We were lucky, you know. We were never going to get much in the way of revenue as a community, as a government, because of the route for that line. But we were able to go down to the legislature and have a consistent, clear ask, and that was, if you don't build this spur line with the way that makes everybody in Alaska who's getting access to Alaska's gas pay for that line as well, so we're all paying the same rate to get the same gas to Alaskans, if we were able to get that language in, the line would have been bumped, yes. And, you know, as I said over and over, we don't need more gas in interior Alaska. We need affordable gas.
Amen. So many people listening and heating their homes over this last winter with historic 40 below, you know, lasting months at a time instead of just a week. It just has been encouraging to watch. And thank you for the reminder of the idea that we need to keep this pace up and we need to keep showing up for meetings. You know, the old adage that the world is run by people who show up for meetings, and we can't take this passively. We've been waiting for 40 years for a gas line, but we do want to do it right. And it's going to take all of us coming to the table, just listening to you name so many people in an election cycle. You know, election cycles can get contentious and everybody's, you know, which party are you and which color are you wearing? And have you as our borough mayor name off so many individuals that, you know, could easily be running against each other, but we're all working together to make this gas line happen for our community. Thank you so much. And thank you for making the time to call in from the Kenai. Go ahead and fill your freezer and have some productive discussions with some of the labor leaders down there and the Kenai Borough Mayor and the others. And thank you for your work on this, Mr. Mayor.
Absolutely, Jen. Thank you for keeping up the advocacy. Lake and Tim, thank you for your guys for delivering jobs to Alaskans. And let's see if we get this line built and make sure that Fairbanks language stays in there. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
I would like to say I'm a little bit jealous that he's down in Kenai. I hear it's record runs, and I'm trying to figure out when I'm going to get to go fishing this year.
Well, so. I know your wife because I knew her before I knew you, and I know she's always up to get out of town and go fishing or hunting.
We've been talking about it, but making it a reality is sometimes different. But.
Thank you for our listeners for staying with us. I know it was kind of hard to hear on his cell phone there, and his voice is kind of hoarse. But you know, thanks for sticking with us. And that was a great intro by our borough mayor. I have two labor leaders here with me in the studio with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and the International Union of Operating Engineers. And thank you, both of you, for joining me today, Tim Brannon and Lake Williams. Several years ago, when I first started working at Public Employees Local 71, Lake, you sat me down and I asked, what is a PLA? And you explained to me what a project labor agreement is, and that statistically in the Lower 48 and other large projects, that these agreements are not some sort of sweetheart deal and they're not some sort of backroom thing, but they're a contract similar the way just about anything in business works, where a union or several in this case, we're going to talk about, you know, the fact that one was recently signed for the gas line. Sometimes it's one union, sometimes it's a multitude of them. And you guys in the trades, you have these hiring halls and you have apprentices and you have people who have earned a journeyman certificate. You have people who are certified for things and people who are just beginning. And can you tell me a little bit about what happens when someone comes to a union and they go through a program to earn their certifications? And then when you sign an agreement with one of these employers, how does that work? Like, can I just call you up and say, I need 3 journey level operators who can use skid steers and belly dump trucks by Wednesday? How does that work?
Well, that's a lot of questions, but I think I'll start with my experience. And when I got out of high school here, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I went to college a couple of years, and then I decided to follow in my grandfather and my uncle's footsteps and applied to the Operating Engineers Apprenticeship Program. My father was actually a Labor 942 member, and so I just decided operators was right for me, and I applied, and I got in. I was lucky enough. Work wasn't very good, but at the time, so they didn't take very many candidates, but I did well in school, and I got selected. You know, it's a 6,000-hour commitment. It's about a $60,000 scholarship. That's what our journeymen have into you by the time you get out.
Because unlike college, you're being paid while you learn.
Yep. So you go down for initial training. It was 2 months of training, and then they get you out on the project, and you earn while you learn. You get a reduced wage while you're doing it because you're bound to tear up the equipment a little bit and make some mistakes, and they're teaching you. But it's more money than most people have seen when you're, you know, 20, 21 years old. And a lot of our apprentices, you know, they have to be taught, and a lot of our classes teach you how to manage your money and save it and not go buy a bunch of brand new toys and then be broke waiting for a job. So
I have been really heartened to learn that a lot of the union apprenticeships, whether it's the carpenters or the electricians or the pipe fitters or the laborers or the operating engineers, that you actually take a real interest in the members' lives and assist them with that.
Yeah. Well, Click Bishop was my apprenticeship coordinator, and I certainly have that long-lasting relationship with Click. He's been a mentor and a friend, and obviously I'm a fan. But, you know, yes, they take care of you. People on the job take care of you. The journeymen look out for you. It's a brother and sisterhood, and we all have lots of females and males, military, people from the rural areas, villages, all kinds of folks go through our apprenticeships. In fact, our apprenticeships, I think, are over, I would say, 98% Alaskans. So when you get an apprentice, you know you're getting an Alaskan. You're not getting someone from another state. There might be one or two, like the Boilermakers or something like that, that have some, because they're kind of a specialty, but you talk about the laborers, Teamsters, IVW, the ones building roads and buildings. They're all local.
But these apprentice schools and apprenticeship programs, I mean, that's where we're going to be funneling people to major projects like this gas line. Folks talk about how, you know, some people will come up from the lower 48 because just like when, you know, in emergency management, when you've got a fire assignment, right, you send a few people there and then you figure out what you need and then you figure out where they reside, where they're available. So we know we're going to have this arc where we won't have enough workers in state initially, but every one of our apprenticeship programs is going to need to beef up, decide how much space they have, decide how many more instructors they can recruit so that we can capture the maximum benefit for Alaskans by going into those programs. We'll have to get some instructors, probably from the lower 48, to beef up those programs so that we can take advantage of that. But in the agreements that were recently signed, we've got some Alaska hire provisions, right?
Yep.
Well, of course, through the book system of each individual local will mandate that you reside in the geographical areas.
I don't think a lot of people know that.
Well, that's one of the benefits you have by signing one of these PLAs or CWAs. You get the fact that there are provisions in each one of the dispatch halls that mandate local area hire, even especially higher within the local geographical areas such as Nikitsky, Delta, Fairbanks, anywhere along the gas line where that's going to be. The gas line is not the only project that we're going to have these PLAs on. We've had discussions with Kiewit. We're working a PLA with them for the Deepwater Port of Nome. And we have brothers and sisters all across the interior working on that project.
So through both of your halls, whenever a project is signed, whether it's the Deepwater Port or the gas line or anything else, when they go union and they're dispatching workers from your hall, you have an Alaska hire provision, local hire, community hire provision from your hall. So people wouldn't see that in a statute or a reg. That's through the policies at your union then.
It's hard for us to speak on everybody's policies, but I could speak to IBW's, and IBW certainly has that provision in their dispatch procedure to start with.
Oh, that's fantastic to know.
A lot of times when we're negotiating those PLAs, there'll be additional provisions, apprenticeship utilization. We like to see a high number. We'd like to see 20% of the hours worked by apprentices.
So what does that mean? What does that mean to the layperson out there? I mean, both of you're in a union hall working for them, so you hear this language all the time, and so you hear apprenticeship utilization. What does that mean?
Well, a lot of the federal jobs, DOT jobs, require a certain amount of apprenticeship hours, and those are the places where our contractors and our apprenticeship programs look to put apprentices. So this is how many hours we have this year. This is how many apprentices we can take in, and it's a way to encourage the contractors to take apprentices and make those spots available for trainees. And it actually saves them money, but some of them, you know,
if because they're working at a reduced rate.
Yeah. So,
but they're supervised by people who are journeymen and signed off and certified?
Yep. Yeah, and we all have training programs. This is a topic that is going to be hard because there are going to be so many workers needed, and many people remember TAPS. It was before my time, but my father worked on TAPS. My grandfather worked on TAPS. My uncle went down to the Union Hall at 17 and signed up. He lied about his age.
Uh-oh.
But, you know.
Sounds like a Bernie Carl story.
Yeah.
A little easier back then.
Yeah, he went out as an oiler, made it, ended up at Golden Valley, and I gave him his 50-year pin last summer. And so those are the kind of success stories that we're going to have. So anybody that is willing and able and wants to work is going to have opportunities. Former Governor Walker talks about working out of several different halls and paying for his school bills, and he really talks, you know, highly about the trade just because he knows that's what got him where he's at. And you hear story after story on my aunts and uncles. They all bought their property and their houses and because of TAPS, and a lot of them didn't continue on after TAPS was done, but some of them did. So,
well, I was encouraged when I first started doing some of this work, and I talked to Doug Tansey previously with IBEW. I've talked to Danny at the Laborers, and I've talked to you, Lake, a little bit about IBEW or at IOUE, IUOE. But there's a lot of people just think, oh, you sign something and then you have to use a union. Well, there's an awful lot of obligations and pride in what you're providing from the union side. You're guaranteeing the work, you're filtering who you're sending to job sites. Someone might do well on the haul road. Someone might need to be in town because they have child obligations or something else. And I've noticed that a lot of the dispatchers know all of the workers and are able to say, this person would do real good with this contractor. I'd rather put this person with that contractor so that they could have a good fit. So the unions really, you guys, sometimes apprentices don't finish because they don't graduate because you're holding them to a standard before you let them graduate.
Yeah, I mean, they have to show up to work. If they don't show up or they have a DUI or something, you can't keep them in the program. So it's really, I know we're all young, we make mistakes, but you can't make some of those mistakes.
And sometimes you guys have redirected someone that, you know, maybe you're not a good fit for this trade, and you'll call and you'll kind of filter with them and take some interest in them and say, you know, you might be better as a wireman.
Yeah, there's a lot of different classifications and specialties out in the construction field. And if there's something that we see that you're missing, we understand most people won't come to us with previous trade experience. But if you're willing to work hard, show up on time, pass a drug test and stay off your phone – We're willing to teach you just about anything you need to know to be a professional in the construction field.
You hear that over and over from the contractors. It's about having people that show up, stay off their phone, and are willing to learn, yeah. and they'll work with them. I mean, it's a different standard than it used to be. It's a different generation. I know every generation says that, but getting people that want to do the work is half the battle. And I would say that you know, these our apprenticeship programs are you know, it's such an opportunity. And when I'm talking to people, I'm like, choose something you like. It doesn't obviously right. I'm advocating for operating engineers, and I always try to push people towards mechanics because we have a huge shortage of mechanics.
Yes,
and,
we do at the state.
And everybody wants to play with the trucks and, uh-huh. and the loaders and in the dirt, and it sounds fun, and it is fun, but if you want to be a mechanic, you can make it anywhere, and you're always the first one on the job, last one to leave. You're always problem solving.
Nothing works without the mechanics.
My plug is right here, mechanics. Yeah. We need mechanics. But I always tell the kids, like, pick something you like. You know, use Alaska Works. Try different things.
Yes.
That's the most important thing, is getting something you enjoy. Because we all the unions have a family wage, family benefits, pension, health care, training. We're all about the same thing, as training our people and trying to have the best people on the job we can.
Well, I know we're set for a break, so you know, as we go into break, I want to just let our listeners know that you can go to the State of Alaska webpage, go to the Workforce Development page, and you'll find a lot of those Alaska Works partnership. They have like an evening class you can pick up, you know, do I like carpentry? You know, introduction to power tools, you know, using a skid steer. You know, they've got a whole bunch of things on there you can try as an introduction before you go to one of the halls and say, you know, I'd like a little more information about enrolling in your apprenticeship program. I think I really like, you know, welding, or I really like doing wire work, you know, or, you know, what you're looking for and what your skill set is. You know, the painters, the carpenters.
Or if you just really want to build a shed in your backyard.
Yeah.
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 Just to learn a new skill and be around people trying to learn the same skill as your interest you.
Yeah.
It's a great place to meet new people, fellow people of the community. I used to teach the introduction to electrical course, and I always look forward to those weeks in the year to get out and just meet new people interested in the trade I do.
About how many apprentices do you take each year in each of your programs?
So we at the IBW, we're all classifications wide. We're between 25 and 40.
Okay.
It really depends on the construction year, the forecast, looking ahead, the jobs that
right.
we know are coming.
It has to be market-driven so that they have a job when they're done.
These PLAs really help with us being able to forecast the work going forward and the requirements for the industry to keep producing journey-level people each and every year.
And that's what I want to talk about going into our next segment is, you know, how that works and how you provide them and what the obligation is on the union site. I mean, you can really save a lot of time when they need two more operators or two more wiremen. We are back on Problem Corner. I'm your guest host today, Jennifer Juhas, and I have with me Lake Williams with the Operating Engineers and Tim Brannon with the IBEW. That's the electrical guys. And we had some thank yous we wanted to shout out.
Well, Mayor Hopkins has done a phenomenal job, and our interior delegation. I certainly watched some of the hearings, and Senator Kronk was very passionate in some of his speeches. I was just in Juneau on Thursday and Friday, and I will say all the legislators I talked to seemed pretty on board. There was very few that were skeptical about the spur line, and it has gone from a someone will build it kind of from Glen Farm message to we will help them build it, or we will figure out how it's going to get built. And it's definitely a priority on Glen Farm's list now, and that's thanks to the help of the mayor and our interior delegation really spreading that word out. So
yeah,
they have done a phenomenal job.
And just watching everyone work together has been fantastic. We have a caller. Welcome. You're on Problem Corner.
Hey, this is Al.
Oh, Al Barrett is calling. Imagine that. Hi, Al.
Hi. So I heard this morning, or maybe it was yesterday, and I'm not a union guy, but there was something put in the Senate bill that said it would be a non-union compete clause or proposal. Can you explain what that is?
I don't know if what exactly. There was language for a project labor agreement, prevailed rates, and apprenticeship utilization that was introduced and passed by the Senate. I know there was a reference by the governor to PLA. Now, Glenn Farn has signed an MOU with the unions that has pretty much agreed to the framework for the PLAs. There's already negotiations going on for the project labor agreement for the early works and the pipeline with the four crafts, laborers, Teamsters, operators, and pipe fitters. And it hasn't been finalized yet, but that's already in place. It's moving forward. Now, the building trade side, this MOU talks about everything from compressor stations, a lot of the stuff that's in phase two, camps, building the camps, operating the camps. So I don't see why that would be a hindrance, because Glenn Farm has already agreed to it in the MOU. We had some Brad press that said non-binding agreement, but I think that was a mistake. I believe it's a binding agreement. Nobody told me it isn't a binding agreement,
right,
including Glenn Farn. So unless they tell me differently, I think we have a binding agreement. So putting it in the bill, is this an insurance kind of thing to make sure it gets done? And this is stuff we talk to our legislators all the time when we're supporting them, is project labor agreements, apprenticeship utilization, prevailed rates. A lot of non-union folks, including my friends, work on projects that are prevailed rate and enjoy those rates for their family. And, we help set the standard for everybody.
Well, and let's go to that, too, because, thanks for that, Al, because the language that both of you are using is a little bit different. And Al called in with, a non-compete thing. But we were talking about project labor agreements before we went into the break and took a caller. And, Al works in fish and game type stuff, and you guys know I pay attention to that. So we say certain things, like we say North American model of wildlife conservation, and people say, people who know what that means know what it means. It's a user pay system, and that the people who are hunting, fishing, and trapping are the ones who are actually paying for the research and the management, and the people who are watching birds get to watch birds, but they don't pay anything in. And I do both. I watch birds. But so this project labor agreement, Al, it's you're working now over at Santa's Smokehouse, and sometimes you make a contract that says you'll supply certain stuff for a price for a duration of time. And so this project labor agreement, we were getting into that. First, we were talking about how we train the apprentices, and people are at different levels. Apprentices are less expensive, but they are supervised by journeymen who, same thing over where you're working. Once you've been signed off on a machine, you can train the next guy how to use the machine. And once you know how to do the pricing, you can train the next guy how to do the pricing. And he makes a little less than you because he hasn't been trained off yet. Well, when we have these project labor agreements, Lake and Tim were on specifically for this. It got explained to me that it actually comes in under budget and closer to time, because instead of, if I lose an operator and I'm the head of a business, and then I have to go to LinkedIn and the newspaper and advertise that I'm looking for somebody and keep it open for 2 weeks and ask the HR lady to sign them up, or if I already have an agreement with you and, someone hurt themselves or moved out of state or left the job for some reason, got a DUI, I can say, Lake, I need two more operators at this level by Thursday to keep the project moving. And then if you've signed that agreement, all that's in that agreement, right?
Yes. I mean, first off, like Glenn Farnon was at the chamber lunch and talked about project labor agreements and how this is a common thing in large scale projects that are, especially ones that are lasting a long time. This could be, 5 to 10 year project. And so you want to have set working conditions, labor conditions, wage rates, so everybody on the project's doing the same thing. Everybody's bidding with the same conditions. It is very common. Obviously, TAPS was done under it. Missile Defense was done under it. We have the Project Nome. There's community workforce agreements that are being used in Anchorage and Juneau that people are very familiar with. But, if you need your workforce, they know where to go. If you need operators, Union and non-union people come into our hall all the time and sign up on our books. If you've gone out and
worked, that's like your inventory. It's your inventory of workers, where if I called Al and said, I'm going to host an event every month and I need so many salmon fillets, his inventory is salmon fillets. Your inventory is workers.
Yeah. I've dispatched plenty of non-union workers out of our hall. I remember a couple success stories that worked at Osborne. Osborne didn't have any work. I had gotten to know them because I worked for Paving Products, and we did all their paving, and they were good hands, and I got them to come in, and I got them out, and they've been union ever since. You know, they just needed an opportunity. So,
and the employer says that when we're talking about these agreements, which I'm so glad that you guys agreed to come on, and you said, oh, I got to study for this. I said, no, we want the basics, Sesame Street. Like you guys were talking to me when I didn't know what they meant. And, as the employer is saying, you know, I'm going to need these things, you know, then I'm going to you. And when we talk about like a non-compete, well, it's the same as saying, I'm going to use Santa Smokehouse for my salmon fillets. I'm going to use IUOE for my operators. Lake, I need so many operators by Thursday.
Yeah, they're going to call the union hall. We're going to sift through all the people on our work list and our apprentices and try to find the right people for the job. Obviously, there's going to be so much work that if you have experience, you're not going to have to go through the apprenticeship. You're just going to come in, sign up on the books, and you should get an opportunity.
Yeah, so a lot of folks out there who have some skills or a few certifications, when you go talk to one of the apprenticeships that is doing the type of work that you like, whether it's one of the guys here in the studio or laborers, painters, carpenters, many others, we've got, you know, other things out there. You come in, a lot of times you'll take a test. I know at laborers, you take the loader test, you get signed off on the loader, then we know you know how to operate it. You get in one of the large pieces of equipment, show me you can back it up, show me your walk around, and you can be signed off if you already have the skills. CDLs are something that you could come in with a commercial driver's license. Do you have an A? Do you have a B? What do you have? The more credentials you have, then the different type of rating you get out of one of these halls, right?
Yeah, there's a shortage of CDL drivers everywhere, and I would encourage anybody that wants to
and mechanics
work construction to go talk to the Teamsters. They need drivers every day.
We're going to go to a break here, and then we are probably going to have Tim Fitzpatrick from Glen Farm calling in. But thanks so much for your call, Al.
Can I talk to you offline?
Yep. When we're not on the air, you can talk to me offline.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we are going to end up taking one of our commercial breaks, and we will be back with the last segment on Problem Corner.
Hey, it's Rebecca Logan calling in to be on air. Hello? Hello?
And we're back after the break. Thank you guys so much for joining me, Lake Williams with the Operating Engineers and Tim Brannon with the IBEW. And we have Rebecca Logan calling online. Can you hear us, Rebecca?
I can.
Wonderful. Thank you for joining us. We've been having a real good show today. We started off with Mayor Grier Hopkins calling us from the Kenai. And just we've really been excited about how this gas line momentum has been bringing people together in Ted's Do What's Best for Alaska, praising 8-Star and the mayor and all of the on both sides of the aisle. And Rebecca Logan is with the Alliance, the Alaska Oil and Gas Industry Support Alliance. And so thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm glad I could call in.
We've just been educating folks as to what the heck is this project labor agreement they're talking about and how those work and how there's obligations on both sides that the industry employer signs an agreement, but that each of the unions has an obligation to train and supply apprentices who work at a reduced rate than people who have become journeymen or earned their certifications, who cost a little bit more but are also able to provide that training, and just how the back and forth works on that.
Yep. And a very important big step for any massive project like this. And a great way to guarantee that Alaskans have a first shot at jobs.
We've talked so much leading up to this, of course, for the last 40 years, and I know you've been involved in those too, but this last year we've been dealing with people in the community who say, but we want to make sure that we're getting the benefit, that we're capturing as much opportunity as possible. I've had Amy Schumacher with the Joint Pipeline Training Center in here before that, you know, we've talked about how the apprenticeship programs need to be ready to stand up and bolster their ranks so that we have enough workers to supply, and that at each of the union halls, many of them, their policy is to hire Alaskans first in accordance with, you know, some things that are in our Constitution. But these project labor agreements end up being the mechanism for that, making sure that, of course, there are going to be people from the lower 48 who will have to come up because we don't have all of the trained workers living right now in Alaska, and that there will be this bell curve of training those workers, employing those workers, and then ramping down as the project ramps down. But what's your take on how things are going down in Juneau right now? Are we're all cautiously hopeful, but do we think that we might have a deal by next week?
Boy, I hate to put money on anything like that. You know, we were doing really well, and Friday we had, I would say, a setback. You know, the Senate took a bill that was really clean and acceptable to Alaskan governor, Alaskans, and the project developers, Glenfarne, and loaded it up with a whole bunch of stuff that makes the project uneconomic. So now we have to go to a conference committee and try to iron out the differences and get something good that comes out of that, that both bodies can pass.
I've tried to make the analogy. Every analogy of anything falls short because it's not the exact same situation, but many of us don't negotiate large pipeline projects ourselves in our daily lives, but I've been using the analogy of buying a home. Right, that we hear people say, you know, don't pay too much for it, don't give them too much of a break, don't, you know, at the same time, trying to buy a house, you know, we look at, you know, what is the overall price of the house, but does it also need work? Do I have to change out the boiler? Do I need to do anything to the foundation? The interest rate keeps bouncing up and down. I know what the bottom line of the house is, but boy, at that interest rate, I can't buy it. Okay, at a 2% interest rate, I could probably buy that house, depending on whether or not I need to change the septic. Is that a fair analogy to what's been bouncing around with the bills on the tax structure?
I do think that's a very fair analysis. You know, people, the project developers are looking for stability, and the state is looking to make sure that they capture a good amount of revenue without damaging the project. And on a project this huge, it's very hard for people to understand a lot of the numbers that are involved.
Yeah, so As we pay attention to them, what is your assessment, if you're able to, you know, what things need to come out of the bill to make this workable and be ready to buy a pipeline?
Honestly, the top thing that has to come out of the Senate version of the bill is the oil tax that they added in. They put in that S-corp tax that has nothing to do with developing a business climate that allows a gas pipeline project to move forward. And it has a huge impact on lots of companies in this state. So that's the number one thing. There were some things added in that made really strict rules about when the project had to start and when it had to be finished. And, you know, we live in environments, as we learned in COVID, that we can't control. And so to do something that defined, that forces somebody to do things, even if the scenario isn't right, that's pretty much a deal killer.
There's a lot of variables there that might be uncontrollable, and
absolutely.
You know, hopefully they can find something more workable for that. You know, you mentioned that for the folks who might buy a pipeline, that the S-corp tax really is farther reaching. I think a lot of people understand how it could apply just to this project, but if you tuck something in as law that applies to several other topics, then, you know, it sounds like something that might be better dealt with as a standalone.
Absolutely, because there's a lot of complexities with that legislation. I think people are ready to discuss it, but it doesn't belong in enabling legislation for a gas pipeline.
Well, hopefully our conference committee will be paying close attention to whether or not that makes the project move forward or not.
There's always hope.
There's certainly, and I would agree with Rebecca, there's certainly a lot of variables, and it's high-level stuff. And, I mean, we have to trust our legislators, but I would just say the alternative tax, it makes sense to me being an in-state user, especially in the early project. You know, we're the ones that are going to be paying that tax, our power plants, the houses that are on gas, hopefully more gas in Fairbanks to help with our pollution problem. So you're taking it out of one pocket and putting it in another. So it makes 100% sense to me that what we're doing in-state use and not exporting, that we need to get ourselves tax break so we get cheap gas for the state.
Well, absolutely.
And that until they've acquired the revenue, they can't pay anything. I heard a lot of people saying, oh, you know, this is state budget's going to go up right after they sign the bill. It's like, well, guess what, guys? We haven't even broken dirt.
Yeah.
There's no revenue to capture yet.
They actually do have some requirements in the legislation that passed the House that actually they got Glen Farm to commit to putting $40 million into a community fund prior to finishing the pipeline in phase one.
Yeah, and there's definitely going to be costs for the municipalities and Fairbanks and Kenai and along the line that you know, you're going to need increased schools, police officers. I mean, there's going to be people moving here with families just like they did in Taps. There's going to be a lot of people around that are here for the work. And it's going to be nuts. I hear the stories. It was nuts back then. It'll be nuts again.
But at least, you know, this go around, we know a little bit of what to prepare for. It's, you know, I've worked emergency management. You never know what's going to happen on an emergency, whether it's a flood or a fire. And you get there and you set up the incident command post. And then we have a better gauge of what we can prepare for, like this upfront payment.
Absolutely.
You know, for folks who are saying we're not capturing enough early and there's no revenue, they've already made this commitment to help us prepare for that. Now it's our job to come together as a community. And it's been so encouraging, like we said at the top of the hour, to see Republican, Democrat, Independent, private sector, government, you know, whether it's our mayors and organized labor all coming together to put politics aside to prepare. We're going to have to do the same thing with, you know, an upfront payment like that.
Yeah.
To prepare. It's our job to prepare our communities.
And there might be a little bit extra expense, but we're also going to be lowering our cost of our heating our homes. You know, the amount of diesel Golden Valley is burning right now, and they can convert over to natural gas as soon as it's here. There's going to be some indirect savings. It's going to be amazing.
Plus the opportunities for our young folks to stick around and buy homes and save for their kids' college educations. The economic impact of this project is going to be, it's probably not experienced by our generation yet. Our fathers and grandfathers had a chance with TAPS, but this is a game changer. This is going to offer that pathway to middle class for our young folks or people transitioning careers.
Absolutely. And we need to make sure that they're really aware of it. You know, we all know about the out-migration we've been facing, and this is a game changer to help us keep our kids here.
We talk about our schools and our school funding. If the young families don't stay in Alaska, buy a home, and pay property taxes, then, you know, we don't have the kids in the schools.
But that's one reason this MOU with Glen Farm in the trades is so important, because it does define, like you said, Rebecca, stability in the workforce, stability in the future, the ability for our kids to realize there is something left in Alaska to stay for.
Absolutely.
And there's going to be other jobs, engineering jobs, civil. There's all kinds of opportunities, and just to have the opportunity for my kids to stay here if they want is huge. I stayed here and I want them to have the same opportunity.
Well, it affects all sectors. You know, my trade was dental hygiene, so it's private sector cleaning people's teeth. And you know, we know anytime a major project comes through like this, you know, workers need services, whether you know those are doctors and dentists and schools, haircuts, you know, grocery stores. It affects every segment. Even though we're talking about supplying the workers right now, it's been so encouraging to see all the different facets of people who can fight about all kinds of other things come together and say, we need this gas line.
When labor and industry speak with the same voice, big things can happen.
Yes.
And that's what
absolutely
this MOU
true.
Is.
And people can never underestimate the fact that this is the only project that has the potential to reduce our energy prices. It may not happen until phase two, but it is the only thing that can do that. And when people really start thinking about that, they start recognizing we need to get this done.
That's true. We've got about a minute and a half left on the show today. You know, that's perfect, wise words to wrap up with. That, you know, I see some Facebook posts, people say, you know, cheaper energy, and then someone will come in and criticize and say, neener, neener. But, you know, without it, you know, it won't be immediate, but it will be there.
You're going to be importing gas. So, you know, it will be more expensive gas in Anchorage, but it'll be cheaper than importing gas. And that's what they should be comparing to, not what they're paying now.
There you go.
And with that first shovel going into the ground to start laying that pipe, the energy and the excitement in all of the major metropolitan areas of Alaska are just going to be felt. There's going to be private money investment, federal money investment, to where the maybe not the energy is the saver, but there'll be jobs for everybody in the future until the pipeline really ramps up.
You know, right now, Glenfarne and its investors are going to be the ones on the hook.
Thank you guys so much for joining me on Problem Corner. The program cuts right in at the noon hour to let us know we're done. Thank you for calling in, Rebecca. Thank you
to
Tim. And thank you, Lake.
Let's get her done.
Yeah.